Okay, so we're talking about arrangement of atoms in space and what are called optical isomers, as you'll see. Okay, this has to do with the problem of proving structure. So they had the idea that carbon was tetravalent. This predicts certain association of things. But does it have anything to do with really the structure, the arrangement of atoms in three-dimensional space? And much of this was done by Kekulé's students, and Kerner in particular, age 26, we talked about showing that the positions in benzene were equivalent and which isomer was which among disubstituted benzenes. But today we're going to talk about another student of Kekulé named Albert Ladenburg. To me, he considers himself pretty smart, and you'll see that in this publication from 1869. He now was on his own, no longer working with Kekulé, and he wrote a paper, Remarks on the Theory of Aromaticity. Kekulé adopts two hypotheses. One, the six hydrogens of benzene are equivalent. Two, each hydrogen atom of benzene has two sets of two others which are symmetrically arranged with respect to it. That's what you get in the hexagon. So 1,2 is the same as 1,6, and 1,3 is equal to 1,5. However, he says, already several years ago, I had the occasion to make Kekulé aware that his graphical formula for benzene is not adequate, this single bond, double bond, since here 1,2 and 1,6 must be inequivalent, while one could have various views about the identity of positions 3 and 5. Why would you have various views about 3 and 5? Yeah. What's one view? That they're the same or that they're different?
Because it depends. If the bonds are the same length, then the same.
Okay, Yi?
You can argue that the order is important.
Ah, so it goes single and double, but one is double single, the other is single double. So if the order is important, they'd be different. But if it's only the fact that there's a single and a double bond between them, then they'd be the same. So you can have different views, he says. But he evidently didn't have much luck making Kekulé aware of this important difference. Both conditions could, however, be fulfilled through alternative formulas, which, so far as I know, have never been proposed before. So he proposes these three structures. That is a triangular prism, or a Star of David. Now, Kekulé then went from Ghent to Bonn, and here you see another of his students, Van 't Hoff, who was only 20 years old then. This is in 1872, and in 1874, so he was only 22 years old, Van 't Hoff made a very, very important discovery, which we'll talk about. But in this context, we're talking about him and Ladenburg, Van 't Hoff and Ladenburg. So in 1876, he was 24 years old, he made a reply to this earlier paper of Ladenburg about Ladenburg's benzene formula. He said, proof that the prism, that's Ladenburg's structure, suffers from the same problem as the hexagon with fixed double bonds, removes the previously asserted superiority from the former and makes the original Kekulé notation not only simpler, but also the presentation with which the facts conform best. That is, Kekulé said that it does oscillate back and forth between double and single bonds, so that those positions then are equivalent if you take the average. But the prism, Van 't Hoff said, won't work for this reason. Okay, so there's the prism, and notice he draws a dashed line there. Why did he make one of the bonds dashed? Anybody got an idea? Yeah, pardon me, Matt? Can't hear. Yeah, it's in three dimensions. That line is hidden, right, if it's a solid prism. Okay, he said the prism formula suffers from the same problem as the hexagon with fixed double bonds. And the problem is this. 1,2, 5,6, and 3,4 derivatives are completely similar. So there's 1,2, 3,5, and 5,6, and 3,4. So those are all equivalent. You could interconvert those red ones by rotation. But 4,5, 2,3, and 6,1 cannot be superimposed. Can you see that? You can't rotate a blue one so it's on top of a red one and have the prism look the same. So in fact, there will be, if you have a prism, there will be two different kinds, he says, of dye-substituted isomers. A 1-3 product is different according to whether A or B occupies position 1. That's what Yeat said about the order, whether it's single-double or double-single. Right? That or that. Okay. Exactly the same thing happens in Ladenburg's formula. An adequate consideration shows that 1-2, that 1 and 2 are absolutely different. So these two, he says, are absolutely different. Right? You can't superimpose it on top of one another. There's an A under there. Okay? And the dashed lines, as you said, show that it's 3D. Now, Ladenburg wasn't about to take this lying down. So he had AB and AB. So Ladenburg replied the next year on benzene formulas. Van't Hoff finds the two formulas below, quote, absolutely different. That's Van't Hoff's word. But notice he doesn't use broken lines, because what he's drawing is a constitutional graph of what's hooked to what, right? So he's not looking at it in 3D space, right? I cannot agree with him in this. Van't Hoff is dragging something into the formulas which I, together with most chemists, expressly exclude. I refer to the arrangement in space. Right? So these guys that knew what they were talking about knew that they were only showing what was hooked to what and nothing about how things are arranged in space. The formula takes account of the composition, right? Which atoms, how many, the molecular weight, how big the molecule is, and the mode of union, single, double, triple bonds, right? So composition, molecular weight, and the mode of union. That's what formula is supposed to show, not arrangement in space. That is, they show constitution. Right? He continues, if Van't Hoff's view of space really will not tolerate the two formulas above to be identical, then I invite him, for his own special purposes, to use a different benzene formula, which was proposed by me in the year 1869 when I compared the hexagon and the prism for the first time, together with the prism, to which it is for me certainly identical. It is the so-called cross of David. So he says this is exactly the same, is identical with a prism. Even Van't Hoff will have to find that these two formulas, the ones shown here, are absolutely identical, because obviously you can flop them over, right? Now, how could that be equivalent to a prism? Well, if you take a prism and look at its connectivity, and then twist it like this, you see, you get the Star of David. Except that I've shown it with hidden lines because it's three-dimensional, right? But it's identical as an abstract 2D graph if you don't dash the lines the way Ladenburg wants to do it. Okay, now these ideas persisted about benzene, this problem of the isomers. This is from class notes taken by a former colleague here at Yale, Raymond Fuas, when he took organic chemistry in the 1920s at Harvard from E.P. Kohler, who you remember is your great-great-grandfather or something like that, academically. He says, benzene gives one monosubstitution product, three disubstituted. Cyclohexatriene, if you had fixed the double bonds, apparently requires four disubstituted products because the two X's could neighbor over a single or a double bond. They should be different, it was argued. And then he shows another example, this compound, where it turns out that the alpha position, that is, hydrogens on a carbon next to a carbonyl group, can be substituted with R's. So you could put an R here, or you could put an R here, right? So you'd expect with this to get two different isomers, right? But in fact, and the alpha means that, okay? So you'd expect these two isomers. We can alkylate, that is, put the R in, to glutaconic acid in several ways, but we always get the same product, only one, never two. Two cannot be made, no matter how we go. Hence, it is not surprising that only one ortho disubstituted product for benzene exists. The double bonds shift until the stable system is reached. right? So there could be two, but one is more stable and it always shifts to be there. That's why you don't see two different ones. Okay. So vibration can be calculated by molecular orbital theory, and that's what we're showing here. And if we show two particular ones here, let's see what I got here. So there's this one, this breathing mode, which if I remember properly is this one, maybe? Yeah, so there's breathing. Let me get it. Okay. And then there's another one. There are many others, but another particularly interesting one is this one. And you see what that's going back and forth between? The two Kekulé structures that go single, double, single, double, single, double, right? So in fact, as the molecule vibrates, it does in fact go between these two structures. It does really go back and forth, but its average is symmetrical. Okay, so there's the breathing, and there's the Kekulé vibration. Okay, now the question is it a single minimum? That's in fact what's calculated by quantum mechanics, like this, so that those Kekulé structures are higher energy forms, and you just go back and forth between them, but they're the turning point to come back to the lower energy symmetrical ones. Or might it be that if we were to force one bond to stretch, the others would stay in step with it, and you'd get something that looked like that, right? Where the lowest energy structure really is like this, if somehow you could stretch one bond. Could you get a Kekulé structure? Well, in fact, Professor Siegel and Busa was the X-ray crystallographer who worked on this in 1988, made this compound where you put a four-membered ring here, which tries to stretch. These angles don't want to be so sharp, so this tries to stretch this bond, right? So if you make this bond long, then maybe you can get that Kekulé structure. So they did that, pushed those apart, and got a longer bond here than here and here. So you could think of that being the longer, the single bond, and these being double bonds. But if that's true, then this one will be long, this one will be short, and that one will be long, if doing that made it go this way. But in fact, it turns out that it's not long, short, long over on the left. They're all the same, right? So in fact, it's not the Kekulé structure, right? You can't even force it to be the minimum energy Kekulé structure. It is a symmetrical hexagon that's preferred, so that it doesn't do the trick here. Okay, so this is what we wanted to say about valence and benzene. And now, and we're talking about position determination, which involved Kerner and Van 't Hoff, as we'll see right now. And benzene, again, is an important player. And now we introduce Pasteur, whom you know of as a microbiologist, but in fact he started as a chemist. Now, it's very hard to prove that two samples are identical, because there could always be some test you haven't tried that shows them to be different, right? All you know is all the tests you've tried do it. Now, for example, carvone, which I've passed around two bottles of, if you measured the boiling point, if the sample's pure, they're not quite pure anymore. They've been open for a long time. But if you purified them, they'd have the same boiling point, 230 to 231, the same density, the same refractive index, how much light bends when it goes from air into the liquid. The infrared spectra would be identical to the extent that any infrared spectra are identical. You know that little changes change the relative intensity sometimes a little bit, but the peaks come generally the same place, so their infrared spectra are identical of the two. The NMR spectra that we'll talk about next semester are identical. So it looks like they're identical. Now, how about the odor? You could smell it. That's something else you could test. What did you people up here get? Anybody notice who has it? The bottle up here. Oh, they're over there now. But anybody notice was it a familiar odor to any of it? It won't be exactly right because they're not quite pure. The liquids are a little brown. They really need to be distilled. But was there an odor you recognized?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amy?
It was kind of pepperminty.
Pepperminty, spearmint, yeah. How about you people back there? Anybody notice it? I'm disappointed in you. Yeah. It smells like rye bread or caraway, right? So here were two samples that had different odor, right? But it just may be they were impure, and that's in fact what was thought for 100 years, right? But it was found in the 1950s that they actually, when pure, have different odors, these two samples. One smells like caraway, the other like spearmint. Okay? And now there's another property you can measure, which is the ability to what's said to rotate polarized light. So I'm going to turn off the how do I do this? Projector and screen controls. Turn off these two. Oh, I want the screen. I guess I have to wait till it gets up there. There we go. Okay, so I'm going to use the overhead for this. Now, first I'll get some light up here. There we go. Okay, so you can see me here. And these are sheets of Polaroid filters, so they take out a little bit of the light, but you can still see me. And you know the trick with Polaroid, that if I go like this, you can see me. Can you see me through it? But if I go like that, you can't. Right? And if I go like that, you can see me a little bit. Okay, you know about Polaroid sunglasses and stuff like that. Okay, so we can look at how different materials influence light, influence polarized light. So I'm going to put this here, and we'll turn this light off again. We'll turn these off. Okay. And now if I put this up here and rotate it, right, it'll go on and off. No big deal there. Okay, now, here I have a piece of some glass, a beaker, and I put that there. And you see the glass doesn't really do anything to it. Right? Or I could put, and there's obviously air in the glass, I could pour water in there. And you can see water doesn't do anything, same phenomenon. You know how this works. The light, you know, the electric vector of the light gets absorbed as it goes in here, but only when it's going a certain direction or to the extent that it goes this direction, right? So if the light comes in vibrating this direction, some of it will be lost. Whatever gets through has to be going this direction, okay? So that if I turn this 90 degrees, then nothing gets through. You know that. I think you all know that about polarized light. Okay? So here's another one. And I'll pour this in, which is Karo syrup. Try not to get everything sticky. And now I'll do the same thing. So what's happened? How does it separate the colors? Remember, it's the light is going, the electric vector is going a certain direction for the light, and it can get then stopped by this one if we turn it 90 degrees, right? But suppose the light, as it goes through the liquid, changes the direction the electric vector goes, right? Then it won't be the same thing that blocks it. You'd have to turn it this way to block it. Okay? Now, if different colors rotate different amounts, then you'll block some of them and not others at a given angle. Right? And that's what's happening here. You're blocking at any given angle, you block some of the colors and not others. Okay? So that's how it separates the light. Okay, so this is another phenomenon we could measure. Take some particular color of light and see how much it gets rotated, how much the electric vector changes as it goes through that liquid. Okay? So you can do that kind of experiment. And I need to get another light off here. Is it that one? There we go. Okay, and this just recapitulates that. You have light come through. If you turn another one and the picket fence is going the same way, it comes on through. But if you rotate it, it gets dimmer. And if you rotate it still more, it goes away altogether because you've stopped it. The light that got through the first one can't get through the second one. But if the sample between rotates the direction that electric vector points, then it will come through. Right, and it'll be even brighter if you turn it at a certain number of degrees, like 45 here in this example. And if there's a different color that rotates a different amount, then if you go this way, you'll see the blue one, and it'll look blue coming through. And if you put it the analyzer that way, it'll be red that comes through. So that's the experiment we just did. Okay. So then there'll be a property of the liquid that's called specific rotation. How much does it rotate? If you have twice as long a path length, it'll rotate twice as much. That's not surprising. So there's a specific rotation, which is how many degrees do you rotate in a given distance, 10 centimeters, a decimeter, with a certain temperature, and you have to specify. It's the number of degrees per gram per milliliter per decimeter. That's the path length. And you have to specify what the color is, because we saw it's different for different colors. And the standard color to use is this yellow sodium D line, as it's called, which was useful because people had access to a sodium lamp that would give just one color of light. And you have to specify what temperature it's measured at, too, and also what solvent it's in, because it can vary with different solvents. But anyhow, if you measure this property, then you have another thing in addition to boiling point, melting point, odor, and so on. Okay, now, it turns out that these two carvone samples, the one that smells like caraway and the one that smells like spearmint, both rotate the light by 62 degrees for this alpha value. But one is plus 62 degrees, and the other is minus 62 degrees. So they're mirror images of one another, right? They're right to left difference. Okay, now let's look at our formulas here of these models, right? If we drew the formula here, right, those two bottles look the same. They look like this. But if we draw model, if we make models with tetrahedral carbons like this, we can see whether they're identical or not. Okay? Now, we could take time to do this, but I'm going to do it slowly. Now, as you look at it here, they look the same, right? On the top, there's a double bond and a single bond. They can rotate like that. Okay? And then you come down, and there's a double bond to your left, the red double bond, the CO. And then there's a double bond here where I'm pointing with my finger, and also here, right? And a methyl group on the bottom. They look the same, but there's a difference. Can we superimpose them? Okay, so I'll bring them on top of one another and put them like this. And have they superimposed? Not really, because this hydrogen points one direction in one and the other direction in the other one, which you can see here if I pull them apart. Okay? So in fact, they're mirror images of each other, right? So if you made models out of tetrahedral carbons, you could make, depending on what mood you were in, this one or this one, right? Or at random, you could make one or the other. And the question is, are they different? Is it just the models that are different? Or are the molecules different? Okay, so we have this. So here are the models with tetrahedral carbon. There's the H back and forward. But the question is this difference real? Right? Remember that Kekulé had this difference to explain two isomers, which in fact was not real, right? Are there two carvones? Now, the same kind of question arose in the context of, carvone wasn't a big deal at that time, but tartaric acid was. You remember, tartaric acid and racemic acid were the two specific samples that Berzelius had used in 1830 when he coined the idea of isomer. When he named isomer, those were the things he was talking about. And they're quite different. They have very different melting points. But they, once people could figure out the constitutional formula, they were the identical constitutional formula. So what's the difference? Well, it turned out that one rotated light, right? But racemic acid did not rotate light in an experiment like the one we just did. Okay. Now, if you heated tartaric acid, you could get a compound they called pyrotartaric acid because it was heated, or sometimes mesotartaric acid because it was in between in some sense. Okay, its melting point was not in between. It was 140 degrees. But it also failed to rotate light, but it had the same constitution, the same nature and sequence of bonds. So there were not just two, tartaric and racemic, there was also this compound called pyrotartaric or mesotartaric acid. Okay, and as if that weren't enough, it turns out there's another isomer. Now there's a problem with what isomer numbers models predict. Sometimes they predict too many. We saw that for Kekulé, right, in the propanols. There's another case we saw where models predicted too many isomers. And that was this one of Paternot where he could rotate and he said these two were two different isomers, which in fact is not true, right? There aren't two different bottles of stuff that differ in that way, right? But sometimes the models predicted too few. For example, maleic and fumaric acid had the same constitution, but were clearly two different things that had different melting points. Or there were lactic acid, the one made by Scheele and one isolated by Liebig, that turned out both had the property of rotating light, but one rotated it to the right, the other to the left, like the carvones. Or tartaric and racemic acid, which is even worse because there's also mesotartaric acid. And it turns out L-tartaric acid. Now let me tell you about that. That was discovered by Louis Pasteur. So he was born in 1822, so in 1848, which you remember was a year of great revolution all over Europe, he was a student, so he was 26 years old. And he was becoming trained in chemistry, physics, and crystallography. He was going to be an interdisciplinarian. So he wrote a paper called On the Relations That Can Exist Among Crystalline Form, so that's crystallography, chemical composition, he was a chemist, and the direction of rotatory polarization, that's physics, that's how this light gets rotated that we just talked about. So now, he worked with tartaric acid. He was trying to learn to do experiments the way Mitscherlich was able to do. Remember we said before that Mitscherlich had this fancy machine called a goniometer that allowed you to measure the angles between faces of crystals very precisely and tell whether they were the same or different. Now Mitscherlich had studied tartaric acid and Pasteur wanted to try to match what Mitscherlich had been able to do. And in fact, he had an idea, Pasteur did, that he wanted to check out. He thought maybe Mitscherlich had missed something. Now, these are drawings that in Pasteur's paper of different crystals. And you'll notice that some of them are just cubes. Some of them have had an edge planed off to give an additional face that one didn't have. And you could imagine planing off this edge here as well, and getting a second face there, and then it would look like this, right, with 1, 2, 3, 4 faces, 1, 2, 3, 4. You see how you could do that. So sometimes crystals show certain faces, and sometimes they don't. It depends on how they grow. Okay, now, this particular one here is the one of the sodium ammonium salt. So it's got two different cations in the crystal, but it's the tartrate. Okay, now, it was known by, this had been studied by Mitscherlich, and he knew that sometimes these edges here were planed off and you saw little extra facets there. But because of the symmetry of the crystal, Pasteur wrote, you'd expect the 8F edges should all be modified in the same way because they're related by symmetry. If one of them's cut off, the other should be cut off as well. Okay? But always only the same 4 of them are faceted, never all 8. So only those 4 he could observe having been cut off. That's something that Mitscherlich didn't notice. Okay? Now, he suggested that maybe that was this, he knew that this substance was optically active, that it was handed. So maybe he said it was twisted, and that made one set different from the other. It wasn't really as symmetric as he thought. Okay? But the racemate, right, not the tartrate, which rotates, but the racemate, which does not rotate light, but has the same formula, right? Mitscherlich had reported that this optically inactive salt, it didn't rotate light, was isomorphous with the tartrate, had the same angles between faces. But Pasteur thought that if this one doesn't rotate light, it won't be twisted. And then it shouldn't have this difference between that F edge and this F edge if it's not twisted anymore, right? And then it should show all eight of those, not just four. So he grew crystals and wanted to look at them carefully to see whether they showed these other edges too, the F primes that are shown there. And what he found was that he never got all eight, right? That's what he expected to see. But what he found was he got crystals that were just like the previous ones, but also crystals that had the other set of four, right? The mirror image of the first set. So he said, I carefully separated the right from the left crystals, and observing their dissolution separately with Monsieur Biot's polarization apparatus. Biot was the old hand at this. He was the guy that went up in the balloon with Gay-Lussac that we talked about earlier on. So he was the leading physicist one of the leading physicists of France. So he had this apparatus to measure rotation. So he took these crystals, dissolved them separately. I saw with surprise and delight that the right crystals deviated the plane of polarization to the light and the left to the left. So he had separated racemic acid into the original tartaric acid and the mirror image of tartaric acid. So now he knew that what racemic acid was. Racemic acid was a 50-50 mixture of the one that was positive and the one that was negative in its rotation, right? So now there are, if you want, four isomers of tartaric acid, or perhaps you should say three, because racemic acid is a mixture of these two, right? But they're three fundamentally different tartaric acids. The one that doesn't rotate light, the one that rotates it to the right, and the one rotates it to the left. Okay, and the D and the L then are mirror images. So he knew that, but this, notice this was 1848. This is 10 years before the idea of valence, so there was no such thing as structure. Pasteur was just thinking in terms of things twisted one way or the other, right? Okay. So that this process of separating a 50-50 mixture into the two pure things, right and left-handed, is called resolution, right? And this was called racemus because it meant a bunch of grapes. That's where it came from. But racemic came to be the generic term for things that were 50-50 mixtures of right and left hand. And you can separate such a racemate into the right and the left hand, at least in principle. If you're skilled enough, you can do it. And we'll talk soon about various ways of doing that. Okay, so what's mesotartaric acid, though? Is it just an untwisted molecule somehow? So that was 1848. So now fast forward 24 years, and we get to this picture we've shown before of Kekulé and Bonn in 1872, and this young guy, Van't Hoff, who got into such a tussle with Ladenburg a few years later. But in the meantime, Van't Hoff had made his big contribution. So here's a picture of Van't Hoff. He died early of tuberculosis, just at the age of 59. Maybe that doesn't seem so young to you. It seems young to me. Okay. He got the first Nobel Prize in 1901, but not for this work. For inventing physical chemistry is what he got the Nobel Prize for. His most admired trait in others was imagination. He really liked poets and artists. And in fact, his hero was Lord Byron. And you can see that the picture he had of himself was reminiscent of Lord Byron, right? But here in 1874, he was a 22-year-old student, and he wrote a little brochure. He wrote it in Dutch. And that's not the paper. That's the title of the paper in Dutch, right? And this is the figures, the one page of figures he had in this 12-page papers. He wrote this 6 days after his 22nd, or was published 6 days after his 22nd birthday, both in Dutch and also in French. But this is what it is in English. A proposal for the extension of current chemical structural formulas into space, together with related observations on the connection between optically active power and the chemical constitution of organic compounds. Okay. So One year later, 1875, he expanded it to 43 pages and published it as a pamphlet in French, Chemistry in Space, by J.H. Van't Hoff, who was now a doctor of science. And he has a quote here from a guy named Wislicenus, which is, the facts require that the difference between isomeric molecules with the same structural formula be explained by different arrangement of the atoms in space. So this was really heretical as from the point of view of many people, as we've already gone on. And Wislicenus, who was a professor in Germany, in Würzburg, talked his an associate of his named Hermann into translating this thing into German. So most people learned about it in this German edition from 1877, so 3 years after the original. So the arrangement of atoms in space is the name of this. It was 53 pages, a few more pages, and you can read some more about it on the website, and you can read about Kolbe's criticism of Van't Hoff. Now, Kolbe was 56 years old at the time. Van't Hoff was only, 24, something like that. And Kolbe wrote a scathing review. He said, it is completely impossible to criticize this booklet in any detail because the fancy trifles in it are totally devoid of any factual reality and are completely incomprehensible to any clear-minded researcher. The brochure begins with the words, the modern chemical theory has two weak points. It says nothing either about the relative position or motion of the atoms within the molecule. For Kolbe, this was absolutely out of bounds to talk about this kind of thing because there was no way of knowing about it, right? So you can, and you can also read whether I have attitudes like Kolbe's there. So he said it was devoid of any factual reality. Is that true? Were there facts that Van't Hoff used to support this hypothesis? So here are the optically active compounds that Van't Hoff cited, the ones that were known to him in his paper. First, there was lactic acid, which was now known to have that constitutional structure, what was hooked to what. And remember, it had been discovered by Shaley. Liebig had isolated the one that rotated light the other way. And Wislicenus had synthesized these molecules. He was the guy, remember, that sponsored the translation and was also excoriated by Kolbe. Now, this is 1911. Remember, that was 1874. So this is 47 years later. Is that right? 37 years later. Almost 40 years later. So a long time later. This is what the Encyclopedia Britannica, the 1911 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, is considered by many to be the best. Anyhow, about lactic acid or hydroxypropionic acid, it says, the two lactic acids are known, differing from each other in the position occupied by the hydroxyl group in the molecule. They are known respectively as alpha hydroxypropionic acid, fermentation or inactive lactic acid, and beta-hydroxypropionic acid, or hydroacrylic acid. So these things are, so there are two forms, the inactive, it says, and the hydroacrylic. And you can see from the formulas what the difference is. What's the difference? What's the difference between those two? Where the OH is. Is it on the end carbon or the middle carbon? Right? So those are constitutional isomers, different nature and sequence of bonds. Okay, so the encyclopedia in 1911 says that those are the two different ones. Okay, but it goes on to say, although on structural grounds there should be only two hydroxypropionic acid, as a matter of fact, four are known. So this is a mystery why there should be others. The third isomer, sarcolactic acid, is found in meat abstract by Liebig and may be prepared by the action of Penicillium glaucum on a solution of ordinary ammonium lactate. It is identical with alpha-hydroxypropionic acid in almost every respect, except with regards to its physical properties. That's, I think, a very interesting statement. It's an identical in every respect except its properties. Okay, anyhow, that's what they said. So there was one that rotated light to the right, and then the fourth isomer, formed by the action of Bacillus levolacti, so it gives left-handed lactic acid, the bacillus, on cane sugar, resembles sarcolactic acid in every respect, except its action on polarized light. So there were four kinds of lactic acid. So this was quite a puzzle. It's interesting that it would be a puzzle still in 1911, almost 40 years after Van 't Hoff's work. And in fact, but it says at the end, see stereoisomerism. And that article, in fact, is a wonderful authoritative article written by Van 't Hoff, who died the same year that the encyclopedia came out. So this is one of the last things that Van 't Hoff wrote. It's a wonderful, insightful article. So there were at least two lactic acids, real lactic acids, right and left-handed lactic acid. And then the inactive one would be the 50-50 mixture of the two. Right, and then there's the constitutional isomer. Okay, but there were also two optically active tartaric acids, right and left-handed, and then there were others where it wasn't known that there were two right and left, but it was known that the ones that were known about rotated light. So there was aspartic acid that was optically active, amyl alcohol. Glucose was optically active, and also levulose and lactose. In fact, the name levulose is because it rotates light to the left. Malic acid rotated light. And most of the derivatives of all these compounds also were optically active. But there were some derivatives that were not optically active. And Van 't Hoff noted that the one that the maleic and fumaric acid, you can get two isomers by removing water from this, H and OH, right? And those were not optically active. And neither was this compound if you replaced that OH by H to get succinic acid. And that experiment was done at Van 't Hoff's direction. Remember, he's only 22 years old, but he had a friend who was good in lab and knew how to do this reaction. So he asked Bremer if he would do this reaction, and he did it. And indeed, as Van 't Hoff had predicted, that one was not optically active. So most of the derivatives of these things are, but not maleic and fumaric acid, and not succinic acid. Now, there's an interesting thing in the... So those were inactive, optically inactive. In Van 't Hoff's obituary, Bancroft wrote, in his whole life he never made what would be called a very accurate measurement. He never cared to. I remember his saying to me 18 years ago, how fortunate it is there are other people who will do that sort of work for us. So people can also contribute by having other people do the work, as Bremer did this, as we said, that this work by Bremer and Van 't Hoff. Okay, now, what is it that these molecules have, but these don't? Right? Why did Van 't Hoff think that one wouldn't do the trick? Well, he had noticed this, that every carbon compound which in solution can rotate the plane of polarized light contains one or more what he called asymmetric carbon atoms. And what was an asymmetric carbon atom? It's the one that's shown here in red, right? The ones that are in italics. Now, what's different about those from the carbon atoms here? Yeah?
Those molecules are both symmetric.
But what about the carbons? The red. What's special about the red carbons?
Their substituents are arranged in like such a way that they're not like symmetric.
But what's special about them that you just know by looking at this? Yeah.
They have four different things
attached to them, which is not true of any of the carbons in these. So these were so-called asymmetric carbons, one that had four different things attached to them, and that gave rise to this property. Good. So these were models that Van 't Hoff made to express this. This, in fact, was the ones he gave to his friend Bremer. And we'll talk some more about those next time. Pardon me? The test is next Wednesday, yeah. I think that's right. Isn't it right? Pretty sure, yeah. Not this coming Wednesday, a week from Wednesday.